somewhere in the beginning of the Rings, there's a scene in which Frodo is talking to Gandalf, and he confesses how afraid he is and how he wishes that he had not been chosen to be the ring bearer. He wishes that he had not even been born in a time when such things are happening, and that such a responsibility could fall on him. Frodo basically is articulating a wish to have lived outside of history, which is really how Tolkien describes life in the Shire, where the hobbits all live. He creates many volumes of the story of Middle-earth, a land of men and elves and orcs and wizards. And in this little corner, the quiet habitat of hobbits who live this simple agrarian life, completely apart from the world of kings and dynasties and battles. Tolkien fills his appendices with elaborate histories of the men and the elves, but there's no history of the Shire. The hobbits have no history. They live outside of history until this moment. And in some way, you can say that they represent what life was like in the Middle Ages for simple people living far away from the centers of power, until all of a sudden history sweeps in, usually sweeps them away. History is something that befalls people like Frodo. And in Tolkien's account, he uniquely has a chance to be an agent in history rather than simply its victim. In a funny way, the mythology surrounding the life of Shakyamuni also describes him as being born and living out the beginning of his life outside of history, outside of time. The hobbits are protected by simplicity and obscurity. Shakyamuni was initially protected by virtue of his wealth and being a prince, having a father who wanted to raise him in a bubble of protection and luxury, shielded from the reality of sickness, old age, and death. And it's these things that one day suddenly intrude upon Shakyamuni's bubble of safety. And he's shocked at their existence, perhaps shocked in the same kind of way, you know, that hobbits are shocked when wizards come to town and stories of orcs and armies arrive at their gate. And Shakyamuni again vows that in some way he must engage the the reality of these things that have intruded on his life. So his initial response is to say that sickness, old age, and death must be thoroughly rejected. And he leaves his home in order to find an alternative to these, an antidote to them. And our practice too inevitably begins with some kind of attempt to reject the realities that frighten us, to seek to find some alternative, some antidote, what's called often a curative fantasy of some place that will allow us to restore the fantasy of living outside of time, outside of history. Now, religion in all cultures has always offered some kind of alternative to this world of old age, sickness, and death, this world of history, of time. And it's often promised access to a eternal or timeless realm. And trying to understand that promise, trying to achieve it, can shape a whole lifetime of practice and belief. What is the nature of that alternative? Now, in Buddhism, we tend not to literally frame it as another world, a heaven that we'll go to as an eternal alternative to this world, although there are certainly elements of that within Buddhism. Rather, we are inclined to seek timelessness within our own consciousness, sometimes in the guise of pure awareness or samadhi, a state that is free of thought, free of emotion, free of attachment, that it has an emptiness, a clarity, that exists totally within this moment, being just this moment. And clearly, one advantage of just being this moment is that it allows you to drop out of time, out of history, seemingly outside of cause and effect. And there's no question that through various forms of meditation practice, we can achieve states that at least temporarily fulfill that promise. And such states can offer us a respite from the turbulence of our own minds, turbulence of thought and feeling, pain and disappointment, and a respite or refuge from everything that's going on outside around us. And in difficult times, I do not begrudge anyone a refuge. It certainly is the case that when the world is in turmoil, it's entirely appropriate that we seek some island of steadiness or peace or equanimity, just to regulate ourselves, to settle ourselves down, to enable ourselves to quell the anxiety and fear enough to just be able to go on. So I think our practice does offer us that kind of self-regulation and solace. Certainly it offers us discipline and regularity in the midst of times that can be either chaotic or feel unmoored and unstructured. All these are ways that our regular disciplined practice gets the ground back under our feet, gives our life structure and meaning, and can create in our meditation itself at least some periods of calm and quiet where we're free of the things that plague us. Yet as Joko emphasized over and over again, we should not call our practice or our sesshins retreats. We do not practice to retreat from life. But if our practice is not going to be that kind of retreat, it has to, in some way, give up on the curative fantasy of creating some kind of inner bubble of equanimity, some bubble of pure awareness, pure being, pure attention, whatever we call it, and allow our practice to actually engage all the things that we ordinarily come to it to escape. We have to make room within our practice for our anxiety and our fear and our confusion. It's not just the alternative to those things, it's the container for those things. But I don't think it's true that practice is nothing but simply facing what we wish we could avoid. A large part of it is, and that part of it I think is ultimately inescapable. No matter how much we try to create a bubble of equanimity, life will always find a way to break down the walls and intrude. So one way or the other, we're always going to have to face the things we wish we could keep out. But if that's all there was to practice, it would be a practice focused on endurance. Simply making ourselves tough enough to face all these things. there's another side to practice that I think changes our perspective on this moment, whatever its content. And that part is very hard to describe or talk about without reinflating the bubble side of practice. But I do think that as we sit, when we sit with that reality of non-avoidance, staying with everything that comes into our body and mind, staying with thought and feeling and anxiety. Those things, in some strange way, are transformed. They're not eliminated. Practice is not a way to wipe the mirror clean and banish all those negative aspects. And yet, when the banishing stops, when everything is allowed to simply stay as it is, when we really get used to the idea that our practice leaves everything just as it finds it, that we're just looking into a mirror, we're changing nothing at all, just looking into the mirror, well, something then changes. The paradox is that the whole ecology of our mind is based on fantasies, dynamics of control and avoidance, and that there's something happens when we give up on the possibility of control, on the possibility of avoidance. The whole inner dynamic begins to shift. Something happens. We leave everything alone. And in that, we may find that there is nothing missing. I called one book, Nothing is Hidden. Might call another one, Nothing is Missing. We often imagine we need to discover or add some special element to the experience we're having in order to give it meaning, in order to make it bearable. And yet, when Dogen says that practice and enlightenment are the same thing, that our practice is our enlightenment, I believe he's talking about this recognition of nothing is missing, that our zazen as it is, our life as it is the thing we've been seeking, that it has its own fullness and completeness, not because we've finally figured out how to do it right, not because our posture in zazen has finally been perfected, so our back is perfectly straight and our breathing is simply coming deep from our bellies or anything else like that. In a very odd way, what we encounter is that the worst sitting we ever had, in which our legs hurt and our mind wandered. And we couldn't concentrate on anything and we were falling asleep. That was it. That was our enlightenment. In the midst, right there. Right? That's the sitting that is most transformative. When we see all the confused particularities of every moment, simply being the equivalent of that morning star, being just what it is in that moment. From that, there is nothing missing. It's a very strange kind of realization. Not particularly the one we were looking for. And yet, it's the one that I think allows us to come back to our life in history, come back to our life in time and finitude, to come back to the life that includes sickness, old age, and death. Because we see that those things are not intrusions or interruptions of our life. They are our life. And they have always been life of everyone, everywhere, at all time. We are not subject to some horrible, unfair exception right now. We're living the life that people have always lived, where their mortality is exposed and inescapable. It can feel that this virus has befallen us in some kind of terrible and unfair way, disrupted all our hopes and our plans. Yet at the same time, it is simply our life. Our life is what happens to us. Our life is what has always happened to everyone. And our practice is finding the willingness to simply face that, not in passivity or resignation, like Frodo, we somehow get the opportunity to be agents in history, not simply its victims. There are all sorts of active, appropriate, compassionate ways that we need to respond to a crisis like this. We neither bemoan our fate, simply hide from it, or give up and resignation. We engage it when we realize that it's not avoidable. It is what our life is from now on. Nietzsche spoke of amor fati, a love of our fate, a willingness to say yes to being mortal, historical beings. Even a willingness to say, yes, I would live this life over and over. That kind of eternal willingness to say yes to the next moment. I hope that when we come together like this, it shows that we can actively renew our practice and our connection with one another. That we're not isolated or stuck or undermined by what is happening, and that we're able, in the face of difficulty, to turn to one another, to rely on our practice, to create new forms. All of these are our way of being just this moment. Not creating a little bubble of awareness or samadhi, a bubble of concentration into which we escape for an hour. But being together, being there in our practice, in our sangha, this is being just this moment, compassion's way.